father was part of the business, so if you were by
my
yourself.
Father retired at age 55 and was then retired for the next 27 years of his life.
That was young to retire in those
days.
Yes,
it was. Very.
Was he ill?
No, he was extremely well.
And he was remarried?
He remarried, yes. Mm-hmm. And he lived in Palestine, or Israel, sorry.
Oh,
from 1951, he lived there about 6 to 7 or 8 months a year from 1951 to 1971 for 20 years.
What did he do in Israel?
Lived. He loved it. He lived in Jerusalem, and he had an apartment at the King David. He had the High Commissioner's old apartment on the first floor, the lobby right off the main entrance. And he became the unofficial mayor of Jerusalem. He just greeter, traveled the country, had friends, relatives.
He was a devout Zionist who got to do what he wanted to
exactly.
do.
Exactly.
That marvelous.
At a young age, really. Mm-hmm.
When he could still enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. He stayed until 1971, and his health started to break down. He died in 73, and we just kind of said, you've got to come back. We can't worry about you over there. And he felt the same way, I think. It just the medical treatment over there is very good, but still, his family, we were all here. So he died here in Florida, as a matter of fact, in December 20th, 1978.
How long did you stay in the business?
30 years, 1978. 30 years, exactly.
Is the business still, is there still a Jaffe store in
Butler? There's not a Jaffe store in Butler, but one store remains out of all the stores, doing very well. In Greensburg, the mall, Cross Company. That's still existing.
And what made you, was there still a Jaffe store there when you left in 1978?
Yes.
Why did you leave?
Because Lois died.
You lived there the whole time that she was ill.
Yeah.
I know she was ill a period of time,
mm-hmm.
and I know that she was very outstanding in
mm-hmm.
Talking to people about it, but I didn't move there, and I'm not familiar. And I know that you accompanied her on a lot of
right.
These times.
Lois taught Death and Dying.
That's, I remembered something.
And
this was a very unusual thing.
Yes, in which she became her own test tube, so to speak. And using her family as a kind of a workshop almost to she always felt that even as a professor when she said I will never teach full time. She had an arrangement with Pitt that I must work in the field a certain amount of time all the time. She said I have to have my hands dirty. She said I don't think anybody can be a good social work professor unless they're out there in the trenches knowing what it's like. And she said, when I'm treating people, I can use my treatment experience in teaching my students in the university.
How did she have the courage to do all this in your family to be so supportive?
She was just that unusual. I posed the question to her when we found out that she had leukemia, and what had happened was that she was in the heart. She just obviously was ill, and it took her in. Dr. Shamovitz said, "You know, we got to put her in the hospital," and said, "I'm not sure what's wrong with her, but she's sick." And this was on a Friday. I picked her up from here. She no longer could drive. I mean, she was ill to the extent that she was still teaching. She had an important meeting that day. She had to be there 8 o'clock in the morning, so I had a friend drive her into the university. And she was going to be busy all day, and some blood work was going to be done in the morning, and then she'd go back in the afternoon. So I went back in the afternoon at 5 o'clock to pick her up at the university and then go to her doctor's office to find out what he saw. And so I dragged her away from her meeting because she'd still been there. Went over to the doctor's office and he said, I don't know what's wrong with her, but she's sick. We can tell her blood's not right. We don't have any proof of anything, but she's sick. So we put her in the hospital that night, which is Friday. That was without nightgowns or make anything, you know, just. So I said, I will go home. I'll open the store in the morning and I'll come right in. And I had a meeting every Saturday morning at 9 o'clock in the store with the employees. And she called me during that meeting and they had come in to tell her she had leukemia. That was before I ever got to that hospital room. And that was a long trip to Pittsburgh. So when I got there, we cried a bit. And so I said to her, well, what do you want to do with the rest of your life? Just like that. I said, do you want to go off to Tahiti? Or what do you want to do? And she always said that was the most important thing that was ever said to her. It was said at the right moment. Thought about it, and she said, I'm happy doing what I'm doing, and I don't want to go to Tahiti, and I really enjoy the way I live. And so she just determined that she was going to live life to its fullest, you know, until whatever occurred, and that's where she lived. And she convinced the rest of us that, and she always, you know, she, as a social worker, she said, this whole thing is just wrong, the way I was told, the way, you know, the way the hospital system works, the way people shun me when they find out I'm leukemic, the way people don't talk about it, and families have agendas. And she just took this whole approach. And as a result of that, she got very involved, you know, with Kubler-Ross, who was a friend of hers, and then Lois started writing a lot of books, articles, appearing on television throughout the United States, writing for Women Today, or whatever they call those magazines, at grocery stores, and teaching her classes, which she did for the next 5 years. She was diagnosed and put in the hospital April 13th, Friday, and died April the 1st, on a Saturday. The reason I always remember the Saturday was that when she was very sick, the first round we never thought the doctor said she's not going to live, she's not going to last this.
Okay.
And yes, acute myelogenous leukemia. And the doctor said, if she survives this first, I said, how long is she going to live? And he said, generally, statistically, about a year and a half.
In 1973,
about a year and a half. He said, that's statistically what we can predict. He said, you know, you never know, but that's roughly it. So, we knew this, and she knew this, and we knew this. And what I was doing was, I still had a dog to take care of, I still had three kids at home, and, you know, and a business to go on. So I would drive into Pittsburgh every day and then go back. And well, this one Friday night, I stayed over Friday night and went into the hospital in the morning to spend some time with her. And I said, well, Lois, I have to leave now. I got to go back to Butler, to the store. I said, you know, it's one of those things that I got checks to sign. She said, well, why do you got to go back? I said, well, I got this to do and that to do and so forth. And I said, I'll be back later today. I'll come back, as I always do. And she said, well, we had, you know, one of those things we had an agreement on was because of the nature of our business, Saturday was the busiest day of the week. And when we first went into business, we were open Saturday night. So I would say to her, you know, just don't schedule any social events on Saturday. Any other night, don't do it Saturday, Sunday. Just, I'm too tired. So, and so this Friday night, when I went in Saturday morning, I said, well, I'll be back later today. And she said, well, she was a little disgusted. She said, well, what if I were really dying today? I said, well, she knew better to do something like that on Saturday. Well, it broke her up totally.
Yes, it's amazing.
Yeah. So she did that for, she taught for 5 years, wrote her books, which some of them are being republished now. I just go, they're all professional books. She wrote a, the Sexual Problems of the Terminally Ill, which is still one of the classic, it is the classic article in the field. And Family Dynamics. And I got a request the other day to republish several chapters from a book that she wrote. And we lived our life. She was in the hospital in that period of those 5 years. She was in the hospital 373 days.
How did the children handle it?
Well, I got them together after we, Cambry diagnosed, and I just said to him, well, look, here's the situation. Your mother has leukemia. That chances are she will live a year and a half, something like this. We don't know. And I said, but I know what she wants, and I know what I think you ought to, the way you ought to behave. I said, what I think you have to do is treat her just as you always treated her. If she's wrong, tell her she's wrong. Just don't baby her, don't coddle her. On the other hand, there's some things in our lifestyle that has to change. I said, I don't want you bringing people over here without first clearing it. I mean, you used to bring anybody in, you could go in that house with four kids, you could find 12 sleeping there, or for dinner, or what, anything. She ran a loose house that way. I said, that's got to stop. If you want somebody to come over, you got to clear it with me first, or with her. See if she's capable of handling it. And I said, the next thing I know she wants you to do is she doesn't want you to stop your life. She wants you to go right ahead and plan. You've got college, you've got school, you've got your friends, you've got those go on. Make sure the dog's fed and so on. That was what she wanted. And that's the way we handled it. And they grew up very fast.
But I did know that Lois did go around to different towns, different groups.
Oh, yes, all over the United States. What she thought was, yes, I went to conventions and lectures, and we had a film crew staying with us. There's hundreds of hours of film on the family, something I don't think we'd ever do again, if knowing what we know now. We had film crews in the house and watching everything, like you've seen on television. We had a Seder when they came to the Seder, and the house was strung with wires, and we did do those kinds of things. And then she went to meetings like with Cougar Ross, and to death and dying sessions and thanatology groups, and she helped found Make Today Count and a number of those kinds of things. She thought that she was interested in defining family dynamics.
Did she get cooperation from her doctors?
She taught her doctors. She taught her doctors, and she would say to them, she was fearless. She would say to them, stop standing in the door. Don't be afraid. Come over here and sit on my bed. Talk to me. And she said, I know you're scared. I gotta know. I want to know what's going on. I want to know what I'm being treated, and I'll tell you how I feel about things. Actually, they used her on the floor because she became hope for a lot of people. Most people continued to die within that 18-month period. She lasted for 5 years, which gave a lot of people saying, "Well, she can do this," and she would go around and try to give those people hope. When you go to, when you're in a hospital for that period of time, that hospital's family, the nurses, the orderlies, you come back week after week, year after year. They know the birthdays, they know the children.
Was she involved with the beginning of the hospice?
Yes, she was a charter board member of the hospice, the Forbes Hospice in Pittsburgh. And when she died, they asked me to take her place.
My daughter-in-law is very active.
Who's that?
My son's wife.
In Forbes?
Forbes Hospital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she did it for 2 years, very concentrated. I just took a little leave of absence.
Yeah. Well, Lois started a group, she made the 12th floor at Presby into a kind of mini hospice. And they had weekly sessions. She organized a psychiatrist to come in and talk to the patients. They could say anything they wanted. Patients' groups. Because we're all in the same boat. Everybody on the 12th floor either had Hodgkin's or leukemia. Or they were aseptic, but it was a particular disease. It was also a blood disease. They were all blood diseases, most of which were fatal.
Didn't you ever feel like bad things happened to good people?
Sometimes.
I imagine your children must have felt that a lot. With the background of religious faith, I think, at some time you have to stop and question.
Lois made death natural. Even death before its time. And I don't feel the same way about dying as I did before. As a matter of fact, she always had a sense of drama anyway, and she had a deathbed scene with the children. She said, this may be the last time I'd be able to talk to you, and it was. Within hours, she was no longer able to talk to them, and she just told each one of them how she felt, what she hoped for them, and what they ought to do. I would never have been able to do something like that, but she did. She taught them how to live through dying. So I think she felt in a way that she tried to make some good use out of this whole process. And she even decided how she wanted the funeral arrangement. She said what she wanted. Who could talk and who couldn't talk about her? She said, I don't want anybody talking about me who doesn't know me. And so I delivered a eulogy. And the dean of the school was a good friend of hers, Black. And it was an experience that I don't wish on anybody, but in a sense, it was unique. She was one in a million.
And then after she passed away, mm-hmm. Then you moved to Pittsburgh.
Okay. Yeah, I moved to Pittsburgh. Then now we're getting back to the Jewish business. I found out from other friends of mine in Butler that if you remained in Butler, one remained in Butler as a widow or widower, particularly an older widow or widower, I mean, there was no social life. And I saw what happened to them if they didn't get out of Butler, and I didn't want that to happen to me. So I decided, matter of fact, Lois and I had talked about that. And every once in a while, man, we went to a party one time at Barbara Shore. You know Barbara Shore, out in. Me and Barbara Shore had a friend of theirs there, and a very attractive widow, and who took a little fancy to me at this party. And Lois, as she left the party, said to me, "Now there's a nice one for you." I said, "Listen, I'll pick my own. What you pick for me?" But she was funny. Black humor was an essential part of our daily life. But I had to leave Butler because I knew that I would end up my evening sitting in front of television, and I did want to marry a Gentile. And that was the other option that was left to me if I remained in Butler. I had a small Jewish community. I mean, where was I going to go?
Either that or you would have done an awful lot of traveling back and forth.
That's right. You'd be going back and forth to Pittsburgh. So I decided that even if I didn't sell the business, I would move to Pittsburgh. That was the only way I was going to have a life.
Now the children.
When you're married and you live in a small town, that was one thing. But all our friends were most of our friends were Gentile and lovers. So where was I going to go with that?
Nowhere.
And they did invite me, and they were nice to me, and they still are. But there's a limit to that.
Were the children all gone by then?
Yes.
I mean, away at school. I
don't yes. When she, last year, yes, by the time Lois died, all of them were in college. Yes.
So there was no need to keep the big house?
No. That's right. There was no need to keep the big house. And I hated the house after she died. It had a fragrance about the house. It was her. I mean, I could smell her perfumes and all the bath oils. It was ingrained in the walls. And I certainly have never forgotten her, it's obvious, but I didn't need to have that tangible evidence.
So where did you have something in mind that you were going to do when you came back to Pittsburgh?
I sold the business. I had no idea what I was going to be doing. I knew I had to do something. I knew that I couldn't get up one morning and find myself without anything in a strange city with nothing to do. I knew that was not viable, that I couldn't do that. So one day before I moved to Pittsburgh, I knew I was moving, that I was selling the business. I went into friends of mine, not close friends, people I'd met through the business world, Prices, well, Prices of Oakland, and they knew me. And I walked in, I said, I don't know, have you heard that I've sold my business? And they said, yes, they had heard that. I said, well, I'm going to be moving to Pittsburgh. And I said, if you know anybody who can use my kind of talents, I know you know all the connections around here. It was one small group. So Mrs. Price looked at Mr. Price and she said, well, we'd like to have you, but I don't think we can afford you. So I said, well, why don't you try me? So they tried me. I said, well, it's more than I would have asked for, but I'll take it. So when I moved to Pittsburgh, I went to work for Prices of Oakland. I was there about 2 months, and I got a call one day from a friend who said, how do you like working for Prices of Oakland? I said, you know, it's a good way to make the adjustment to Pittsburgh. I said, I'm sitting in the heart of Oakland, I'm near that hospital, I know half of the nurses that come into this store. I said, the people with Prices are, it's a wonderful store. There's no problem. My manager of a store that doesn't have any real problems is successful. I said, they pay me very well, almost too much. I said, actually, it's very good. I said, the only problem I find with it is I'm bored. I said, I didn't think I would be. I'm surprised. I said, I know why I'm bored. It's their store. I know as much as they do about this business. They make all the decisions, which is correct. It's their money. They ought to. But I said, other than that, it's fine. She said, well, do you think of changing jobs? I said, I just got here. I can't do anything like that. She said, I said, what are you talking about? She said, well, there's a job at the museum that you'd be perfect for. I said, now listen, you know, I've never worked at any museum. I don't know the words to know, but I know you. And I think it'd be ideal. Would you mind if I mention this to Jim Walton, who was president of Carnegie Institute? I said, well, I guess I don't have any objection to it, no. And I figured that was the end of that. And lo and behold, 2 weeks later, I get a call from Jim Walton. Said your Paula Atlas was the person who had recommended me. She'd known me since college days. We'd gone to Penn State together. I don't know if you knew that. That was before Howard's time. Paula had graduated, but
yeah, and she was there too.
Ralph. Oh, to Bill.
Bill
Skirble.
Yeah, that,
right.
That I knew, and then I lost contact.
Then she married Ralph Atlas,
yeah.
Who. So I had a double connection with her, Ralph Atlas and Paula. So Jim Walton came to interview me. We met at Barney's, T.J. Barney's, And at the end of the interview, it was over lunch, he said, I'm going to the Bahamas. He owns an island there, you know, James and Helen Walton. And he said, when I get back, he said, we'll get together. He said, in the meantime, I may have the person who's doing this job, who is an outside person, consultant, talk to you and be with me. So I did get a call from this consultant and met with him for about 4 or 5 hours one day. And when Jim Walton came back, he had said, I want you to meet with a few people. Kim Fisher from Fisher Scientific, some of the trustees, and I met, had 10 hours of interview. Then they asked me to write a paper. Oh, talk about being Jewish.
Oh,
yes. This is really new, because this is what you're interested
mm-hmm.
in. Okay. I was being interviewed by Jim Fisher. I don't know if any of you know Jim.
Who he is.
Jim, I arranged for Jim to come and visit, meet me at my turf, my little townhouse on Reynolds, which was very sophisticated. It was a really sharp place, filled with all artwork that I had collected over a lifetime. I've been an art collector. That's how Paul thought of me, book collector, art collector, I've done all these things. So he came in and he started interviewing me. And said, well, you're from Butler, yes. And I always said, I know Butler very well. I said, yes, I've lived there all my life as president of the synagogue and sort of, but I better right up front tell him who I am. He knew I was Jewish. He said, oh, well, I said, I know. He said, there aren't very many Jews in Butler. I said, no, they're not. He said, well, that means that most of your friends were Gentile. I said, that's right. He said, that's good. He says, you'll know how to get along with us.
Right
up front.
No questions.
No questions. Well, after 10 hours of interview, then they asked me to write a paper. I'm now 58 years old. I've been a boss all my life, and suddenly I'm writing papers, and applying for jobs, and filling out forms. I couldn't believe it. And they asked me how I saw the job. What did I think of the job? What would I do? So I wrote a couple pages. Didn't hear from them. They were interviewing other people. I knew this. So I figured that was the end of that. I couldn't understand what they would want with this skinny, gray-haired Jewish guy from Butler in this WASP world, being an assistant to Jim Walton. But I went on a vacation from Price's. This was in June of 1979. And to the Spoleto Festival in South Carolina, I come in the hotel room. There's a call waiting for me. It's from Jim Walton. So now, if you want that job, says it's yours. Just like that. I said, well, Jim, I'll take it, I said, but I've got to tell him the prices, and I said, you may have to wait a month or two, you know, or three, depending. And, well, I started with him July 1st of 1979. That's how I got to the museum.
What was your job there?
A director of planning and development. They had 5 men do this job in 5 years before me. Everyone failed, all professionals, people have been doing this all their lives. And at the end of the first year that I was there, I went into Jim and said, Jim, you have to celebrate today. I lasted longer than anybody you ever had on this job. And so I stayed there I was there 2.5 years until I left the Federation. But that's a real lost world. But they wanted me to help them with the Jewish community. Now we're getting back to being
fun.
Not only just fun. Jim recognized that there was that the Jewish community saw a kind of separateness between the museum and the Jewish community. And he said, there's a perception that we don't like Jews, that we don't want them. And he said, that's not the way it is now. And he said, I don't know how to overcome it. Anything you can do to help me would be very much appreciated. So I did go about that task, and we did improve things very much. We got Porter on the board, and got Ed Haskell on the board, and there was only one Jew before, and he kept every other Jew out. You know who that is. Jim Winokur.
Oh,
yeah.
What?
You know, Jim really had his own.
He kept his status.
He was Dick Skate's close buddy. He still is.
We have our own worst antisemites.
Yes, of course. He was. I don't think he really wasn't going to foster, you know, make it closer. So that's how I got to the museum. That was an interesting experience being there.
I would think that would be. When you said that it was your title was to
Director of Planning and Development,
you know, in the direction of the exhibits, the collections, or in endowments.
Mostly endowments, yes, and. Also telling them, you know, things that I thought would be good for the museum, kinds of activities. For example, when I